This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, I interviewed Professor James G. Kahn about universal healthcare, thanks to the Institute for Public Accuracy for arranging this interview for me. So that's coming up here on why we don't have universal healthcare. And then Eric Richardson addressed the Eugene City Council about the fentanyl epidemic in Eugene, which kind of relates to healthcare. Would we have a fentanyl epidemic if we had healthcare? So that's coming up after James G. Kahn, Professor James G. Kahn. And then, you know, there was this conviction in the news. I'm doing this intro, recording this intro, on the day that they announced the conviction of this mass shooting defendant that got life because his mother drank alcohol and damaged his brain while he was in the womb. So would we have all these mass shootings if we had universal health care? I wonder. Wouldn't these people be diagnosed and helped in some way rather than wandering around and allowed to get guns if we had universal health care with a mental health component? So that's all coming up here on Talk is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Please support independent media. It's the only place you're going to get the truth. I'm talking to Professor James G. Kahn of the Health Justice Monitor. He's recently written an article for Institute for Public Accuracy. What other organizations do you work for, Jim?
Well, my academic appointment is as emeritus professor at the University of California, San Francisco. I'm in the Institute for Health Policy Studies.
Okay, and so how has the lack of health insurance caused the U.S. to have one of the lowest life expectancy rates in the world?
Well, there are a number of reasons. Most recently, the drop in life expectancy that was seen over the past few years, which has been a drop of 3 years in longevity over two calendar years, from 2019 to 2021, a big piece of that was the fact that populations with high rates of uninsurance, that is, bigger percents of people lacking insurance, had a worse experience with COVID. More cases, more hospitalizations, and most importantly, more deaths due to COVID. Some colleagues did an analysis which showed that the prevalence of uninsurance increased the number of deaths by one third. When you do all of the math, that comes out to an added 339,000 deaths due to lack of insurance. And by now, that number is even higher. So that's one big piece of the story. And that reflects several things. Slow access to medical care to get tested and diagnosed and alerted to not put friends and family at risk. And also slower access if people get sick from COVID, slower access to care. So that's a huge piece of it. Another piece of it is ongoing growth in the number of firearm deaths. As you and your listeners know, the extremely high number of firearms in the hands of private citizens is associated with a stunning number of annual deaths, about 40,000 currently, due to both intentional and mostly accidental deaths. So that's a big contributor. Another one is the opioid epidemic, that is the abuse of legal opioids, including fentanyl, which is very risky for overdose. And that's a growing problem as well. And then finally, an ongoing issue in our dysfunctional healthcare system is that even people who are insured may have very substantial cost-sharing requirements that lead them to delay or skip care. These include large deductibles of $2,000 to $5,000 and high cost-sharing for visits and for drugs. So there's lots of evidence that people skip or delay care because of financial barriers. And when they do that, they are at risk of getting sicker and potentially dying from chronic health conditions. So a lot of factors go into the stunning and depressing drop in longevity that we've seen in the U.S. in recent years.
Well, so you mentioned COVID specifically, and maybe you've answered this, but would you go as far to say that it might have been an endemic rather than a pandemic if we had healthcare? Is that why there was a recent article on accuracy.org where they said that there's an additional 300,000 people that have COVID because of lack of health insurance? Would you say that it would just have been an epidemic rather than a pandemic?
Well, we could get into technical definitions of all of those things. So something that's endemic means that it's around at a low level on an ongoing basis. And in fact, COVID may turn into that, but certainly the onset of COVID wouldn't fit that definition. I guess you could say that if we had reacted more quickly and more effectively, pursued a more rapid and concerted public health response, our experience with COVID might have looked more like some other countries that did far better, like Taiwan did especially well through very good data systems, very good access to care, and very good data systems about access to care. So when people got sick, the health system knew about it right away. And that was a much better response than we had. So perhaps we could say that we would have had something more like an epidemic rather than a pandemic. Pandemic means sort of hitting everywhere. But I don't focus on the definitions of these epidemiologic terms. For me, the fact is we had a much higher rate of infection and death in our country than in almost any other country in the world, reflecting an inadequate public health response as well as ongoing inadequate health insurance.
Right. I mean, we would have been able to stop it at the retirement homes is where it started.
But certainly retirement homes were hit hard, and there were several issues there. Again, slow recognition is part of it. Inadequate protection for healthcare workers meant that they could acquire and then transmit COVID. Some healthcare workers had jobs in multiple nursing homes, in large part because they didn't get paid. They don't get paid a decent wage, and so they're forced to take a second job. And so they acted inadvertently, of course, as a transmission vector between different nursing homes. And those are very vulnerable populations.
Well, and we didn't have the equipment or the resources. There weren't enough masks and there weren't enough ventilators.
Right. There weren't enough masks, which is the how you reduce transmission. And of course, weren't enough ventilators to treat very sick people. But the failure on both of those was a failure of response and planning. It would have been possible with a more rapid recognition of the problem, a response to it, and a bigger role for the federal government in mobilizing our available resources. The administration in the White House at that time, first of all, was slow to respond, but secondly, declined to invoke powers that they had to organize and compel responses. There's a capacity that the government has and uses all the time to compel private manufacturers to do things necessary for the national interest and safety and security. They declined to invoke that for the pandemic. They invoke it all the time for military purposes, but they didn't invoke it when it came time to produce and distribute masks, and they didn't invoke it in the area of vaccine distribution. The one thing that the government did quite well was to throw money at large vaccine manufacturers who did an astounding job at designing and testing vaccinations, but then rolling out the vaccinations was impaired by a lack of vision and coordination and a lack of willingness to treat this as the serious pandemic or epidemic or whatever you want to call it.
Well, because, yeah, I noticed that we were to depend on Walmart and Walgreens in the beginning for our health care. Anything on that? What's the danger of relying on a multinational corporation instead of a government to get your vaccine?
Well, I don't think there's any problem at all with getting vaccines at Walgreens. I think that's actually a very smart distribution plan. From my point of view, the problem was not that we wanted to use widely available private sector entities. The problem was a lack of coordination. That is to say that the federal government has a role, should have a role, in bringing together Walgreens, Walmarts, CVS, big medical groups, et cetera, to say, here's our plan. Here's how we're going to vaccinate. We will get you the vaccine doses by such and such a date. We expect you to be delivering them the next day. That kind of planning, which would be kind of like mounting a military campaign, was lacking. What we needed was to mount a public health campaign. And again, the White House not only failed to acknowledge the severity of the pandemic initially, they issued misleading statements. They got in the way of CDC's efforts to do things. And according to a recent, very recent report commissioned by CDC, in general, CDC could use some shaping up in terms of its ability to identify and respond to pandemics.
All right, so moving on, why don't we have access to healthcare? Why don't we have Medicare for all?
Well, we have a very cobbled together health insurance system. The central part of it is employment-based insurance. That started in World War II because it was a way that employers could offer a valuable benefit while still abiding by the freeze on wages. And then that grew and grew, and that is the single biggest a type of way that we get insurance, but over the years, the type of insurance that people get from their jobs has degraded. And now most insurance plans from work have large deductibles, often several thousand dollars, before the coverage even kicks in. So every year, generally starting in January, people aren't covered until they've spent a lot of money. And as a result, people delay and skip care. So that part of the system is falling apart. We have similar types of problems in the publicly funded sphere for things like Medicaid, which of course is health insurance for the poor, and Medicare, which is health insurance for the elderly and long-term disabled. Both of those programs are highly variable. Medicare is national, but there are various components to it called Medicare Advantage and traditional Medicare, and each of them has their strengths, but each has some very substantial weaknesses. And the Medicaid programs are generally not strong, and they vary state by state. So each individual component in the system, each individual type of insurance has big problems. And then about 10% of the adult population is simply uninsured. And so they don't have any insurance to call on at all. So it's a very cobbled together, broken system that leaves people with financial barriers, and if they do seek care, leaves them with financial burdens, medical debt, and an astounding number of medical bankruptcies. Now, that we are alone. We are way off to the side compared to all other wealthy countries, and there's a group called the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is the group of wealthy countries. And we just are completing a study. We looked at 33 other countries. And there are some absolutely standard approaches that all of the other countries use. First of all, they cover everyone. Everyone has insurance. That is so far from true from here. There are minimal or no deductibles. So you don't have this period of the year when you're wondering whether you should save your money or get care. And so that's really valuable. Everyone's covered with the same exact insurance. That's super efficient. Doctors have to deal with only one insurer, also super efficient. Right now, we spend on the order of $800 billion a year just to manage this crazy system we have for health insurance. And if that money went instead into providing care, everyone would have great insurance, and we'd actually reduce our healthcare spending overall. So as for the political question, why given the clear evidence that a single payer system and improved Medicare for all like other countries have would work well, why don't we do it? Well, one word, profits. There are lots of people who make a lot of money in the insurance industry, pharmaceutical industry, big provider organizations, and they're powerful. They're politically powerful. They have the ear and soul of elected officials, and that makes a huge barrier. I'll just additionally say that support for a federal role in ensuring that everyone has health insurance is growing. If you ask a fair question about single payer, would you like the government to pay for all health care if it meant higher taxes but no more premiums and no more cost sharing? About two-thirds of Americans say yes.
Well, and even the corporations that originally started offering health insurance so they wouldn't have to raise wages, that situation has changed, hasn't it? And wouldn't it be better even for corporations and everyone to just pool all their money together in one thing rather than have several different health insurance companies competing with one another?
It would be much simpler.
Even for corporations.
If we said employers have a role to play here, they should pay 8% or 10% of payroll into a fund that then gives health care to everyone. That's the rule. You may be exempted if you're very small or may pay less than 10%. But right now, companies do have to deal with very complex issues around who gets insured and with what kind of coverage and which broker and which company. And it's a big burden for them. And it's not fair to employees. Another thing is that because your insurance is linked to your work, there's a phenomenon called job lock, where people may not like their job. They may want to get a different job. They may even want to go out on their own with an innovative small business startup, and they won't do it because they're afraid of losing the insurance coverage they have. Although it's imperfect, at least it's something. And so, yes, we are sacrificing our competitiveness in a large degree by versus other countries by having this onerous and confusing and distracting job-based insurance.
Right, and so what role does the AMA play and pharmaceutical companies play in keeping health insurance private and not funding Medicare?
Well, private insurance, the health sector, which is huge, of course, has every interest in keeping the system the way it is, where not only is there a big private insurance sector, even the public insurance sector, Medicare and Medicaid, is now largely giving the public money to private insurers to oversee health plans. So the private insurers very much have their hands in the public till, and in fact, almost all of their revenue growth in recent years has come from that, from Medicare and Medicaid. And so it's unsurprising that they're fighting tooth and nail to retain the system that we have. The situation with doctors is more complicated. The AMA is the essentially largest trade organization for doctors in the country, and a significant percent of doctors belong to the AMA. The AMA has a long and sordid history of opposing what they characterize as socializing medicine. And ironically, they vehemently oppose the establishment of Medicare. And now doctors like Medicare because Medicare is a huge source of income for doctors. But basically, the AMA tends to defend whatever we have because in some fashion, some big chunk of doctors benefit from the arrangement that we currently have. So there's an increasing interest in single payer in the AMA and membership, but it's still not quite enough to tip the balance, and the leadership remains adamantly opposed, not just to supporting single payer, but to even considering it, even doing a study. There's another group of physicians, not as big as AMA, but more open-minded and progressive. It's called the American College of Physicians, or ACP. And the ACP has endorsed single payer. They do believe that single payer is a very important option. There are also other very progressive doctors groups. And young doctors in general are more interested in these kinds of progressive changes. So I think we're seeing a shift, but it is a slog. There are leaders who are benefiting financially and who represent people who are benefiting financially, and they're fighting any kind of big change.
All right, so I worked as a file clerk for a nephrologist, and I don't know if you're familiar with it. A nephrologist, these guys are like the gods of doctors. And like you would send someone to these guys when you couldn't figure out what was going on with your patient. The nephrologist, who's basically a gland specialist, they're the ones that could figure it out. And these guys really were brilliant doctors. But even they, I don't know that they are doing it for the money as much as and they weren't outrageously wealthy. But what do you say to a doctor who is better, who is a very good doctor and feels that he deserves to be paid well for what he does? And this argument, you know, that both these arguments that you wait in line at socialized medicine clinics. And also, you know, I notice there's new discoveries in socialist countries have new discoveries in medicine all the time. So do you need capitalism? Do you need competition to discover new treatments?
Well, you just said a lot. Let me try to unpack it. First of all, the single payer plans that I'm familiar with, and I do know most of them in the United States, do not anticipate trying to reduce the net income of specialist physicians like nephrologists and endocrinologists and surgeons and so on. The plans that I've seen basically assume that those doctors will continue to get about the same amount of income. Maybe the doctors who are making $2 million a year, there'll be a cap and maybe they won't be allowed to get that much. But doctors who are currently earning $300,000, $400,000 a year, which is an excellent salary, will continue to do so. And the way that they'll do that is a couple of things. First of all, right now they all face many different payment levels. They may get, for a particular service, they may get $300 from a private insurer and $200 from Medicare and $40 from Medicaid. So it's very confusing, and all of the contracts are different. They may have literally scores of different contracts, and the payments are different for each one. Instead, there would be one payment rate that would be roughly a blended average overall, the whole system, a blended average. So in the example I gave, maybe it turns out that the Medicare rate is approximately the average, and then you do the calculation, and then basically everyone would get the Medicare rate. And so they would be kept whole. Now, another piece of it is the cost that doctors pay right now to maintain a billing operation consumes about 12 to 13% of physician revenue. That is, 12 to 13 cents on the dollar goes to managing the billing and receipt of the payments. That's a huge amount. That would drop to about 3%. So you'd have about a 10% savings right there. That could go into the pocket of the doctor. There are various other aspects to it. There's been some writing about all of this. Doctors would do fine. Now, another point you raised is, will we get investments in health if we have a socialized payment for healthcare? I want to make a distinction. This is not socialism in the sense that, certainly not communism. We're not talking about shared ownership of means of production. We're talking about the government paying for privately delivered healthcare. That's the model in most countries around the world. Now, someplace like Sweden, actually, the doctors work for the government. But you don't have to do that, and we're not proposing that. Canada is the closest example. Government pays for healthcare, but the providers are in private business. And there's also some public facilities, and that's fine, but it's up to the providers to decide how they want to organize themselves. They're just getting paid by the government. So I try to stay away from the label socialism, because that means many things to many people and usually not right. The closest I'll come to that is I'll say that the European system, which, again, is based on largely on public payment for private services, is what we might describe as democratic socialism. That's what Bernie is. In the United States, someone like Bernie is considered fringe left on healthcare. In any other country, any other wealthy country, any other country in the OECD, he would be middle of the road. He would be considered sort of the standard, having standard views. That's how skewed we are. Every other country, including very conservative countries with governments that are far more conservative than the Biden administration, they all just accept that it is both fair and efficient, and let's throw in generous, to provide everyone with healthcare. They spend 25 to 50% less than we do. They spend a lot less across the board. They cover everyone. The longevity is longer. Our system is broken, and we know it. The question is, when will we fix it?
Right. These doctors actually threw out the HMOs because the HMOs you couldn't get them to pay them. All right. And so, again, I'm trying to wrap it up. So it's more of a co-op, really. I see it as more of a co-op. And like I say, you're pooling your money together to get better prices. What about, which brings me to pharmaceutical companies. Wouldn't we get, don't we pay them, first of all, for their research? The drugs that they're selling us, a lot of them has gotten public money for the research on those drugs. And wouldn't we get a better deal from pharmaceuticals with single-payer health insurance? Medicare for all.
Well, there's plenty of excellent pharmaceutical research that goes on in countries around the world that have a single payer, including Canada and Norway and other countries, Germany, this notion that you need to charge twice as much for drugs as any other country in the world in order to support research has so many flaws in it. We could do a whole separate show on that, but let's not do it right now. But basically, it's a misconception. It's a public relations ploy for the pharmaceutical companies to threaten that there won't be any good drugs anymore if we lower the prices. That is BS and should be called out as such.
All right, Professor James G. Kahn, anything else? Are you releasing, are you writing a book, or you have a class at the University of California?
All of
or
those
San
things.
Francisco?
I am very excited about work that I'm doing with a colleague on the association between the challenges we face in our democracy these days with the huge division between the right and the left and the threats to election integrity, and with just so many of our basic values in our society being at risk, such as the value we put on equality. And I think those problems in our democracy are echoed in our current healthcare system. Equality is a really good example. We just have a grossly unequal healthcare system, and no one benefits. Even the people who are kind of near the top of the pile, they don't do any especially well. And if we had single payer, everyone would have equal coverage, and that coverage would be better than essentially any coverage we currently have. And again, it comes to getting rid of this stupid waste of $800 billion a year that we spend in order to have a broken and unequal system. So I am writing a book about the connection between democracy and healthcare.
All right, Professor James G. Kahn, thank you very much for your time and good luck with your great work that you're doing.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, do you want to give your name?
Sure. My name's Del Quest, and I work for Lane County Public Health in the suicide prevention.
All right, so what is the state of mental health care right now in Eugene?
Mental health care is very taxed here. It's underfunded, it's overwhelmed, and I feel like we need more mental health providers.
And why? So why do we need more mental health care?
You know, our youth, I work especially with youth in Lane County, and they're struggling with their mental health on a lot of levels and for a lot of reasons. And so having access, easier access to mental health would be really helpful for them.
And so a lot of it is biological?
No, I wouldn't say it's biological. I would say a lot of it is systemic. I would think it's, you know, pressures at school and it's pressures in just kind of daily life. And so they're struggling with some external factors as well as perhaps just some normal factors that youth struggle with.
Well, what about the future of the planet?
I think that a lot of folks really are stressed about that and thinking about climate change and other kind of situations that need to be fixed that we don't have a lot of control over.
And, you know, schooling costs a lot of money, and they're potentially going to be working at a fast food place, maybe?
I don't know that they're thinking that far ahead. I think they're just kind of focusing on what's right on their plate right now, which is just high school and getting through those kinds of things, watching their families struggle, and just kind of day-to-day stuff.
All right, and so what does Suicide Prevention of Lane County Coalition do?
So our Suicide Prevention Coalition does a lot of education with mental health providers, school educators. We're working with lots of different facets of the community to provide education about mental health and suicide awareness and how to support somebody who's experiencing suicidal ideation. And then we do, you know, we do other projects that are supportive of people with lived experience and just anything we can do to bring awareness to suicide prevention.
All right, and so what does someone do if they're feeling suicidal?
The first thing to do is ask for help and find somebody who can listen and support you, and then reach out for some mental health care if that's available. But the primary one is to make connection with somebody who cares with you.
Well, but and so do they contact the Suicide Prevention Coalition of Lane County, or
We're not a hotline, but we can sure provide resources. So there are several organizations here in town who can provide support through a hotline. But the primary access, the easiest access right now for people is the number 988, which is the suicide prevention hotline. And people can connect to services through that. And then they can also go to our website and look for resources. The website is suicidepreventlane.org. And that, you know, on our page there, we've got a list, an extensive list of resources.
All right. Anything else you want to say about suicide prevention?
Just that I'm really glad for events like this that help raise awareness and get people talking about it. There's a lot of stigma around it still that we need to get rid of. And having an event like this where people are just really engaging in the conversation is one of the primary steps to making some changes.
All right. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Nice to see you all. Hi, Eric Jackson. Ward 1, but it might be Ward 7. I'm not sure. All the speakers tonight were very articulate in what they had to say, and I appreciate the residents caring about the town as much as they do. I'm also one, and I'm here to address something that is... let me take this off so I can actually be seen. The fentanyl challenge that the city is having right now is absolutely beyond comprehension. I was out of town in California for a few weeks and came back to being asked between the Whitaker at the Red Barn Natural Foods place to 11th and Adams three different times out of vehicle windows, SUV windows, if I wanted to buy blues or heroin. That's never happened to me in 5 years of being on the streets in this town. Never. Not once, not ever. I was carrying a skateboard after midnight, just walking down the street. I wasn't doing anything, but I was that approachable. I would think you guys could stop some of these people that are coming from out of town in vehicles to distribute this in our town. I have a very close friend that just died of a fentanyl overdose, but he thought he was buying methamphetamines. Either one, is it right? No. But if you think you're buying one thing and you inhale another, you could be dead 5 minutes later. There's been reports of people having laced joints, marijuana, coming from the streets. And in Oregon, everybody gives away pot since the day that I got here, and it hasn't stopped yet, including me when I came back from California. But I knew where mine was grown, and I knew how mine was handled. Not everybody does, and that's a big problem. I want to say that you guys are doing a stand-up job. There's 500-plus more beds for temporary housing for homeless than there were 2-3 years ago, not 10 years ago. The permanent supported housing is absolutely phenomenal, and keep it up. Don't stop. It's working. It changes people's lives. I'm watching it every day. You guys can give yourselves a round of applause, and COVID a round of applause, because I don't know if you would have had any of the money to do any of it without it. So thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your work.
This is from The Insurgent. About 24 folks took over the UO Law Center lounge on Friday, September 9th, to escape the wildfire haze descending on Eugene and hear Nevada give a talk on their book, Abolition of Law. The Abolition of Law event, hosted by UO's Radical Organizing and Activist Resource, or ROAR, Center, was originally planned to take place at the Urban Farm, but chaotic climate conditions forced local organizers to occupy whatever indoor public space they could raid. Guest speaker Nevada spoke as a resident of Minneapolis concerning the 2020 George Floyd uprising from its point of genesis. They dug deep to offer critical insights about how the uprising unfolded and many of the tactical innovations the rebellion initiated. Their book, The Abolition of Law, looks at many theoretical and concrete aspects of the rebellion, while explaining in detail the chronology of how actions and ideas developed. Now, 2 years on, Nevada has started to explore many of the social conditions surrounding the Minneapolis scene. This has led them to become familiar with what is known as the, quote, sideshow. Sideshows are informal gatherings where people bring their cars to do burnouts, drag races, and just display their vehicles without any formal organization. This space where the formality associated with the driving and licensing of vehicles is relaxed or abandoned reveals a critical insight into one of the key innovations developed during the 2020 Rising. People were able to effectively loot big box stores like Targets and Walmarts in Minneapolis. These large capitalist structures are often positioned at the periphery of urban areas and also seated in large parking lots that insulate them from mass foot traffic. In Minneapolis, people were able to overcome these obstacles to redistribution through massive and rapid use of vehicles. In this way, some of the most exploitative commercial entities on the American landscape were sacked by communities who had suffered most from the big box hollowing of the central urban landscapes. Nevada also detailed how open spaces adjacent to police precincts made it impossible for police to fully disperse people and acted as rallying points that continually put pressure on besieged precincts. Additionally, once people threatened these police spaces, police had no capacity to respond to mass redistribution occurring across the urban landscape. On a theoretical level, Nevada has dived deep into how the uprising was eventually muted and the rhetoric authorities employed to trigger a mass response in mostly white liberals and leftists. They made special note of how the Minnesota Governor Tim Walz blamed white supremacists for invading Minneapolis and blamed them for looting, all the while it was clear that communities were rising against a system structurally built upon white supremacy. Nevada was deeply struck by how this rhetoric instantly turned the tables on people actively engaged in rebellion and even pitted leftist elements against the continuing mass action. This led them to the insight that many liberals and leftists were, quote, more about fighting individual white supremacists than fighting a system of white supremacy. People began to organize to protect property and enforce curfew. This form of self-policing intertwines the concepts of private property and white supremacy and brings about an anti-abolitionist structure. In the end, an anti-racist narrative was appropriated and mobilized to protect a racist system. Nevada has taken this into the exploration of the concept of race treason. In this idea, the intrinsic connection between whiteness and property is the central mechanism to be dismantled. This, of course, brings about heavy theoretical questions concerning radical redistribution, which is one of the most pressing issues in the radical left. The conclusion that Nevada has come to is that, however uncomfortable it may be, the day-to-day navigation of race tension is a continuing experience of resistance against white supremacy. Alternatives to the existing systems of oppression include self-regulation through feedback and communication. This is in contrast to the self-policing and law, which are static moral judgment. Self-regulation is the norm in non-political, or what Nevada calls, quote, anti, spaces such as the sideshow. This atmosphere of takeovers and self-regulation propagates a transformation of the world in real time. Nevada does recognize that such inner phenomenon as a solution can be a dangerous illusion, but they also see the value of gaining the time and space to make an autonomous decision. For Nevada, the existing framework of political organizing is white, and for this reason, the issue of race treason becomes truly urgent. When the institution of private property becomes threatened, many people become instant reactionaries. When looking at the place of white abolitionists involved in the process of dismantling white supremacy, it must be recognized that, quote, we are not the protagonists. The goal is not to make us roadblocks. We'll be right back.
In the face of the full police, they cannot act collectively. Nothing holds it together but an idea. There is no possibility of change in their lifetime. In the face of the thought police, they cannot act collectively. Individually, they cheat, forge, blackmail, corrupt children, spread disease and prostitution in the name of spreading knowledge from generation to generation. Until in 1,000 years, war effort is always planned to keep society on the brink of starvation.
The war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects, and its object is not victory over Eurasia or East Asia, but to keep the very structure of society intact. Be continuous. The essential act of modern warfare is the destruction of the produce of human labor. A hierarchical society is only possible on the basis of poverty and ignorance. In principle, the war effort is always planned to keep society on the brink of starvation. The war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects, and its object is not victory over Eurasia or East Asia, but to keep the very structure of society intact. In principle, the war effort is always planned to keep society on the brink of starvation. The war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects, and its object is not victory over Eurasia or East Asia, but to keep the very structure of society intact. Its own subjects, and its object is not victory over Eurasia.